aching questions, even tickling ones. Okay. Trying to decide what I want to do next. What I'm going to do next, and this will take a little bit of attention on your part, because I'm going to skip something and have to come back to it. You're going to have to remind me to come back to it. So what I'm going to come back to is paragraph 24, which I haven't talked about. But I want to set it up a little bit by talking about the schematism problem, because I think if we open up the problem, then we may get somewhere. So my claim, just again, look at it, Kant's claim is that the structures of space and time in general, the structures of space and time in general, are particular determinations of the more abstract category-determined structure that is common to all experience. Structure, space, time in general, it's a particular case of the more abstract category-determined structure that's common to all experience. And that, therefore, this is a huge therefore. This is why Kant says we give laws to nature. It follows that the structures of space and time, the structures of space and time are a human expression of discursive categories. Really, the next 3 minutes is going to be about showing that. Showing how the structures of space and time are a human expression of discursive categories. Say a word about paragraph 24. Just important to let's look at paragraph 24 briefly. I'm going to do this. The question is, how do we get from logical functions of a judgment to applications of categories to intuitive manifolds? How do we get from something purely intellectual to something that is partially intellectual and partially sensible? So the next bit is simply how do we do it, and then I'll give content of how do we do it. And the how do we do it, the answer is via the imagination. And that in a way makes sense, so I'm now going to at least give you the intuitive idea. If we think of this moment as the moment of spontaneity, kept going on about, and if we think that what we want to happen is for the spontaneity to affect our forms of sensibility, which are what? Our forms of passivity, our forms of receptivity, then the question emerges is how can something purely intellectual encounter something purely sensible? In short, how can we cross the divided line? All philosophies are footnote on Plato. Obviously true. But Kant feels this in a almost unbearable way. That really is the nugget here of the struggles over the rest of the book, namely how the intellectual human activity and human passivity get connected. And I could give you a long story, but of course we already know, right, that the relationship between activity and passivity was the debate between rationalists and empiricists. For rationalists, everything happened up here. For empiricists, it was all sensibility. The idea of discursive cognition was, right, thoughts without intuitions are empty, intuitions without thoughts are blind. So the very notion of overcoming the duality of active and passive is what the project is all about. Without, and this is Johannes, you know, giving me a hard time at the break, without absorbing one into the other, and therefore, if here, you know, this is the area of, you know, mind, spontaneity, reason, this is the senses, then there's got to be something that is both intellectual and sensible at the same time, and Kant calls that imagination. And in particular, he calls it the productive imagination. So, productive imagination, you should feel that statement as an oxymoron. That is, the production of something that itself is sensible. Which is one way of thinking why we care about art, right? Art is a heightening of an oxymoron. Art's about the oxymoronic structure of human discursivity. I'm sure that will make no artist feel comfortable. Or you may say it's about the aporetic structure of so Kant says in paragraph so the question of paragraph 24 is how do the categories that apply to the senses, that's all he's talking about here, preparing the way for paragraph 26. And he says, look, synthesis, therefore, is at once transcendental, necessary condition for possibility of knowledge, and also purely intellectual. But since there lies in us a certain form of a priori sensible intuition, which depends on the receptivity of the faculty of representation, the understanding as spontaneity is able to determine inner sense, the manifold of given representations, in accordance with the unity of our perception. not just as a statement, it's a claim. Pure intellectuality determines inner sense, our temporal consciousness. Next paragraph. He's going to entitle this, so spontaneity first works out here in the middle. Spontaneity is going to work on inner sense, and he's going to call this the figurative synthesis. So we have an intellectual synthesis. Intellectual, I mean just SSP. But now we've got to take that intellectuality, that pure human rationality, and have it encounter somehow. And how is really going to be, we'll be working out in the schematism and the analogies. It has to encounter sensibility, and it's going to encounter it via the imagination. So, the synthesis he says, the figurative synthesis is directed. And he wants this figurative synthesis, as he says, to be nothing more than the original synthetic unity of apperception. So, the figurative synthesis is literally a kind of sensibilization of original spontaneity. So it's via the imagination that we move from the purely intellectual, let's give a definition of purely intellectual. Let's call it anything that's purely intellectual if it is merely a rule. So every concept we know is a rule. Categories are super rules. So they are rules without anything attached. And these rules can a priori determine a manifold via the imagination. So he says, B152, imagination is to that extent a faculty which determines the sensibility a priori, and its synthesis of intuitions, conforming as it does to the categories, must be the transcendental synthesis of the imagination. So that it's as if the first thing I must do is unify my imagination. This synthesis is an action of the understanding on the sensibility, and is the first application, and thereby the ground of all other application to the objects of all our possible intuition. As figurative. It is distinguished from the intellectual synthesis, understanding alone. Insofar as the imagination is spontaneity, I sometimes entitle it the productive imagination. So, let's get concrete. Turn over B154, the new paragraph at the top of the page. We cannot, he says, think a line without drawing it in thought. So, first sentence. Nothing can be spatially imagined. And he's taking the notion of geometrical figures to be as simple as it gets. After all, geometry represents the pure form, right, of the spatial whole. So his first statement here is that I cannot imagine, conceive of a line. We cannot think a line without drawing it in thought. What he means by this is that anything that is spatially given also includes a temporal dimension, so that the what appears to be just something that is there has to also get there. Again, no unity without unification. So what is simply, the most spatially simple thing, a line, has to be drawn. Or a circle without describing it. Same thought, the given, in other words, the rule here. I mean, what he means, what does he mean by that? That we can't think a circle without describing it. Anyway, let's get it right. All right, mathematicians in the room, what's the definition of a circle?
Breadless length. Breadless length.
Definitions.
Oh, a circle. I thought you said.
Definition of a circle.
Equidistant from the radius.
Yeah, it's an object in which all points are equidistant from the radius. What the hell is that? It's this. It's that. In other words, he says the pure rule. Right. So that movement from purely intellectual purely temporal has to be spatialized, just as in the case of the line, what is spatialized can only be thought if thought temporally. In each case we are joining, right, a rule and an image. We are joining a moment of passivity to a moment of activity, and in joining a moment of activity to a moment of passivity, right, we are showing how, and I'll come back to this in a moment, every moment of spatial awareness depends upon a temporal understanding, and every moment of temporal understanding requires spatial awareness. Even time, he says, now moving to the other case, even time itself we cannot represent, save insofar as we attend in the drawing of a straight line merely to the act of the synthesis of the manifold, whereby we successively determine inner sense, and in so doing attend to the succession of this determination of inner sense. So, the imagination drawing a circle, drawing a line. Is the way in which my activity, the rules, shortest distance between two points, or there are all points of equal distance to a single point, receive their sensible realization, and where any sensible realization gets brought back into an intellectual rule. So we're moving to the productive imagination is the means by which we give original structure to our sensibility. So imagination is going to be the in-between. And now the question is going to be, how does the imagination work? What's going to be necessary here? How is this categorical determination? How can we make explicit? What's our next question? How can we make explicit the categorical determination of sensibility? Yeah.
Just before we move on, how off the mark would it be to say that the imagination treats rules as if they were images, as opposed to saying the imagination joins images with rules?
I guess I won't say that's right, but just don't get lost in the notion of rule here, where rule is the intellectual moment. So how is Kant going to make explicit this categorical determination of space and time? It turns out it's going to be a bit more complicated than we thought. Kant claims that all knowledge is subject to time, because time is the form of inner sense. And yet, that argument that time is the form of inner sense, all knowledge is subject to time, plays no structuring role in the justification of the category. What's going to happen in the schematism and the analogies is that they are going to argue, and this is my argument against the completeness problem, the schematism and analogies really argue for particular categories by offering a two-stage theory of time determination. On the one hand, the schematism is going to continue the regressive strategy of the transcendental deduction by claiming that we have knowledge of the temporal relation of objects distinct from our representation of them. I'm going to give an example of this. You can just see people going crazy. We have knowledge of temporal relations, of objects that are distinct from our representations of them. What I mean by that is the order of my representations is not the temporal order of the objects. This is the principle of everything that's going to follow. Let me repeat it and then demonstrate it. The temporal order, the temporal relations of objects is not the same as the order of my representations of them. Example. I have a nice example. I see the hat, and I now see the projector. Hat, projector. The order of my representations is first the hat, then the projector. And I can't see them both at the same time. Okay? They're just outside my peripheral vision. What is the temporal order of those two objects? Anyway, they're simultaneous. How do we do that? How do we do that is the argument for the next 2 weeks. Because it certainly seems as if we suddenly have knowledge of a structure of the world that is different from the order and structure of our representations. So our representations really do represent something independently of us. That is clear now, okay? If it wasn't clear up till now, and you've all been thinking it's not, that really makes it clear, right? That we have knowledge of an order independent of the order of our representations. Now, having that knowledge, Kant's going to argue, requires three principles of temporal determination. And the three principles of temporal determination is the claim that the objectively real is ultimately composed of permanent substances of a determinate magnitude and that these substances of a determinate magnitude all stand in relations of causation and interaction. The relationship between the hat and the projector is a relationship of interaction. Those three principles, substance, succession, and interaction, are the three analogies. And the three analogies together generate the unity of time. They are the conditions for determining that all objects are in one time. That is to say, since time is an intuition, it is a one, then all objects have to be temporally related to one another. And these three principles will give us how they are so related, that is, how they all belong to one time, and therefore stop the universe from exploding into different times, which would be unintelligible, right?
Except I know a pub now.
Many years in Britain, you're watching Doctor Who. Anyway, so stage two, and this is all schematic, getting to the schematism, is going to say that these same principles provide the necessary conditions for the possibility of experience in not just the strong sense that I've just given, unity of time, but even in the weak sense of without these three principles, I could not even have minimal self-awareness. Ooh, I just had an idea. Ooh, that even that little thing requires all three principles. And that's going to be the argument and the refutation of idealism. That is, my inner awareness is dependent on my outer awareness of this whole elaborate temporal structure. So that's where we are going. The schematism shows exactly how categories can be manifested in or as sensible intuition. That is, what the goal of the schematism is to give each of the categories sufficient spatiotemporal content. Or we might say its goal is to give each of the categories a temporal semantics. Or we might say its goal is to give each of the categories a temporal interpretation. All these, I'm thinking, are more or less equivalent. So, Kant thinks that there is no, and I want to be clear here, there's no general problem of concept application. When people misread the schematism, Kant does not think there's any general problem of concept application, because Kant thinks that mathematical concepts and ordinary empirical concepts and even the empirical concepts of natural science just are rules for applying predicates to particular objects. That's what they are. Right? To have the rule for red is to pick out red objects. To have the rule for circular is to be able to draw a circle. I mean, they just are, right, rules for the application of concepts to experience. And that's what Kant says when he talks about the dog. It almost comes as light relief when Kant actually mentions something concrete. And that he even goes, kind of lets himself go a bit crazy and mentions a dog. Wild man, Immanuel Kant. So, A141, and this, by the way, is meant to be also Kant's solution to the problem of abstract ideas. Right? That, as you know, if you remember Berkeley's criticism of Locke, you know, how can you have an idea of a dog that's not a schnauzer or a bulldog or blah, 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 blah. And of course, if you think ideas are images, then this problem looks insuperable. Right? Kant says that's not what concepts are. Again, concepts are not images, they are rules. The concept dog signifies a rule according to which my imagination can delineate the figure of a four-footed animal in a general manner without limitation to any single determinate figure, such as experience or any possible image that I can represent in concreto actually presents. So, ordinary empirical concepts just are their own schematism. Put it that way. The schematism of our understanding and its application of the appearances and their mere form is an art concealed in the depths of the soul, etc. Now, of course, there is something missing here. We might say, you want to think about this for a moment, and then I'll give you the answer to the puzzle. I take it that our concept of a dog is a four-footed, you know, mammal with, you know, his hair, not fur, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we give that description, and you want to say, well, how come that's different from a horse? How is it that we get from that rather abstract concept, that's called the dictionary definition, to Fido? So he's shown us, fair enough, that concepts are not images, but if they're rules, they look as if they underdetermine particular cases. How does that underdetermination get accounted for? This is driving Hope crazy. Good. Well, this is the kind of thing, you know, you want to have friends who are philosophers, you want to stay up all night arguing about. The answer occurs at A133, B172. Suddenly talking about judgment. But judgment not in the way we've been talking about it, but judgment as not just the faculty of rules, he says, but the faculty of subsuming under rules. So to judge something is to subsume it under a rule. The rule that everything that has this, that, and the other property is a cup, right? That's the act of judgment, is subsuming under rules. And then he says, it seems shocking, that the general understanding contains no rules for judgment. So judgment is the subsuming of objects under rules, but the understanding contains no rules for the application of rules. No rules for judgment. Why? Well, Kant's first answer is that to ask for a rule, for the application of a rule, that is, when do I apply the rule dog? Why is that going to be a problem?
Infinite regress.
Infinite regress. So if I need a rule for when I apply the rule for dog, then I need a rule for applying the rule for applying the rule for dog. And you get an infinite regress. So there cannot be a rule for the application of rules. That judgment requires, that's what he says of A133, and that's why he says that judgment must be a peculiar talent which can be practiced only and cannot be taught. Very close to Aristotle on phronesis. Very close to Aristotle's Critique of Plato. Right? That you can't be a rationalist all the way down. You cannot have an algorithm for everything. You cannot have a rule for everything. Right? That there's a notion of mother wit involved. Practice, training, discrimination. Okay. Well, so there's no, fundamentally then, if this is right, then there really is no fundamental problem about empirical concepts. You learn them, you learn how to use them. Now you can see why suddenly Wittgensteinians and Kantians come together, right? Because just as meaning is use, so he's saying here, well, concepts are use. I mean, there's no, so Kant's not a rationalist, much closer to Wittgenstein. You know, the meaning of concept is its use. It is a rule, but a rule that, and this was the very problem of the logical investigation, right, Wittgenstein wants to say a rule does not project itself infinitely into the future, right, to determine all future cases. That's the belief that it does is just what generates skepticism. Right? That's what that's how you generate skepticism about meaning. Meaning is impossible. Why? Because you can't predict whether a rule will apply to some future case. And the Kantian answer is right here, that's a logical error to even expect that. To even expect it is an error because of the infinite regress argument. If it were a rule, then there have to be a rule for the application of that rule ad infinitum. So ordinary concepts are in great shape. They fit experience just beautifully. There are certain complications. We'll call that the Critique of Judgment. Another course. Skip that. But that's what the Critique of Judgment is about, trying to think a bit about that raw talent. So schematism only applies where there is a genuine gap between concept and object. And the question is, well, where is there a genuine gap between concept and object? Well, it's in the special concepts of transcendental philosophy, namely the pure concepts of the understanding. And now the notion of pure concepts should make us kind of nervous, right? Because these are categories not cast in terms of properties and relations that can actually be manifested by objects given through sensibility. Or, we're back to Hume's problem. There is no sensible impression or idea of a causal connection. There is no impression above and beyond having the representation of this object that tells me that this particular set of properties belong to an external object. Right? You wanted an impression of externality. Couldn't find one. Wanted an impression of causality. Couldn't find one. So there are certain properties that Hume expected to find in empirical intuition, and he could not find them. That was his skepticism. Those are the concepts for which we need a schematism. Let's stop there. I don't see any further thought when people are late for the next class. And we will pick up there next week.